mean, I think it's certainly something we should be focusing on. I think equality on lineups and stuff is a big thing as well, and making sure that kind of, you know, everyone with talent should be getting a look in. You know, everyone that's got ability and kind of that should be on lineups should be on lineups, whether it doesn't matter what kind of gender, race or sexuality you are. You know, you should be on there. We have definitely been through a period where the industry has been quite male dominant, and I think we're now starting to see a shift and the right movement where people are kind of being represented a bit more, and you know, lineups are starting to look a bit more diverse and stuff, and I think we just need to keep on pushing that.
You're listening to the Mission Makers Show, a podcast that inspires humans to get into the mindset of success. My name's Farah Nanji, and I'm the founder of a business in the motorsports industry that explores leadership lessons from things like Formula One. I'm also a DJ and music producer in the underground electronic scene, and a public speaker on key topics like resilience, building high-performance teams, overcoming learning difficulties, and stimulating creativity. And to tie it all together, I love writing thought-provoking content as a journalist for these industries which are so unique in themselves. On this show, I'm sitting down with some of the most inspiring and driven people I've met around the world to talk about their processes, their failures, the lessons they've learned, and how they are truly making an impact for this world. Hey guys, and welcome back to season 3 of the Mission Makers podcast. For today's episode, I'm joined by possibly one of the biggest DJs in techno, Alan Fitzpatrick. Alan has succeeded in challenging all of the rules of techno while carving a very unique niche in his field. He's released on Drum Code, Cocoon, Bedrock, to name a few, and he commands dance floors around the world with his robust, raw, and emotive sound, regularly guesting in the most prestigious stages around the world, from DC10 to Berghain, Fabric, and everywhere in between. In 2016, he founded his own label, We Are The Brave, and in just 5 years, the label has already accumulated 30 million streams on Spotify. There has been no stopping Alan in the pandemic either, with 2021 seeing his first album released in a decade. Released on Anjuna Deep and titled Machine Therapy, the album is a fantastic sonic understanding of how Alan has challenged the techno playbook and carved out his own therapy in the studio with all of those incredible machines. We talk about making music during these strange times, breaking boundaries, defying expectations, and so much more on today's episode. So just before we begin, if you're interested in watching the video version of this podcast, head over to YouTube and type in Alan Fitzpatrick Mission Makers to see the show, and also you can see where he recorded his album. And if you're interested in some really cool rewards like DJ lessons, the chance to ask our guest questions, and exclusive merchandise, head over to www.patreon.com/missionmakers to check out how you can access these exclusive rewards. And thank you to all of you who've been writing in to us and subscribing to the show. It really makes a difference. So don't forget to hit that subscribe button if you love the content that we're making here at Mission Makers, and help us take this show to the next level this season. Hey, Alan, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Yeah, not too bad at all. Not too bad. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute honour and pleasure. So I hear you're in Southampton, and that's where you grew up, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, you got into the scene, from what I hear, from a very young age. So what were the kind of key moments that drove you to the electronic scene, and what was the scene like in Southampton growing up?
So in Southampton, when I was younger, I wouldn't have said there was a huge amount of a kind of electronic scene that I was really involved in, really. I mean, my first kind of explorations into kind of nightclubbing and listening to electronic music was actually in Bournemouth. I would go down with friends, which is obviously fairly close to us. It's probably 35-40 minute drive. We'd go down to Bournemouth and go clubbing in a club called the Opera House, and the event was called Slinky at the time, which was would have been around 1999, going into sort of the millennium. But that's where I first sort of cut my teeth as a sort of clubber, I guess, and was hanging out down there with sort of school friends and going into sort of college friends. Basically, first time walking into kind of a room with lasers, smoke machine lights, and kind of just got absorbed by that whole culture of nightlife. All sort of started in that venue, really.
And so what did you kind of learn from your early observations and your early years as a young DJ?
Just basically to sort of soak up the culture of performing. I think when I was first, I had turntables quite an early age. I was 14 when I had turntables. So I was clubbing in and around that sort of time. We had some fake IDs and we were getting into clubs from about 15, 16 years old. And I just got immersed into the culture of hearing different sounds and different cultures of people and everyone kind of dancing to one beat, really. And when I took that on as my kind of approach to DJing, was just to make sure that I try and capture that energy in my DJ sets.
Did you always knew then when you got your turntables, like this was the path you wanted to take? Because it definitely wasn't so defined back then. It was quite ambiguous as to how to like become a DJ and how to sort of make it.
Yeah, I mean, there was never any, certainly back in the late 90s going into sort of early noughties, there was no sort of, I guess, yeah, like rule book on how to get into music and how to get into DJing and stuff like that. It was all very much kind of word of mouth. Someone knew someone that was a promoter, or, you know, kind of you kind of just drifted through a network of people and maybe found the right people to contact in terms of getting into DJing and stuff. But for me, you know, being in those, having those early experiences in nightclubs and seeing, being kind of mesmerized by the like lights, the music, and I think from those early days I was like, this is what I want to be doing as a career.
Did you decide to go to university or just go full throttle into the music industry?
I went to I did a BTEC diploma in music technology shortly after leaving school. But I think I got about 8-9 months into the course. It was a 3-year course. I got about 9 months in, and during the process of the start to finish of that 9 months, I was kind of spending my salary on my salary on buying equipment and building up my own sort of home setup studio wise. And during that 9 months, I was writing music at home. I actually ended up getting a track signed in 2002 to a record label called Toolbox with my friend Dave Robertson, Reset Robot. And I think I just decided, well, I've made it now. I've got a release coming out and I don't need to be doing the course. I can spend more time at home making music. And I dropped out of that course and just was focusing on writing music at home. Naively, really, I should have stuck the course out and I would have probably learned a lot more quicker. I feel like I know everything that I need to know now in terms of what I would have learned from that course, but certainly probably should have stuck it out back in the early days, but got overexcited that I had a track signed and thought, right, this is it, and, you know, and went for it. But what I will say is that did give me the I guess the sort of balls to make that commitment and to sort of jump into stuff two-footed and see if you can make it work, and it paid off.
And was it always techno from that age when you were
I was making kind of harder edged music then. It's still sort of techno, but hard techno, UK hard house, and maybe some like trancey bits, but overall the kind of core basis of my music all the way through has always been techno led.
And so if I may ask, how were your sort of family supported through that process?
Yeah, very supportive. When I was making the track that I got signed in 2002, I remember making it in my bedroom studio with my friend Dave, and my mum bringing us up cups of teas and biscuits and letting us kind of just do our thing in the bedroom, but they've always been supportive of my music, you know, and they've never been one to be banging on the door asking me to turn it down and stuff. They've always been pretty easy going, and I think that's massively helped, because having their support is, it's not an easy career to explain to people, especially parents and stuff, when they don't maybe fully understand the scene or what it is you actually do. So to try and explain to maybe a different generation what kind of being a record producer and a DJ is about is, as I say, quite ambiguous. As you say, it's quite random, so having their support has been massive.
Absolutely. Something we always like to sort of go a little bit into on this interview or on this podcast is the meaning of our guest name. So we looked up what the meaning of Alan has, and it has a couple of different meanings depending on the origin. But something we picked up on most notably is that it can actually mean harmony in the sort of Celtic background. So which that's obviously quite interesting given your musical background and experimentation with harmony through your music. Do you think this meaning might represent your character in any way, shape or form?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a perfect fit to me. I've never really looked into all that sort of stuff, so that's pretty cool. But yeah, I guess harmony is a good word to use when you're a producer and you're playing with a lot of different instruments and different melodies, different kind of soundscapes. That's quite cool.
Yeah, no, definitely. Sometimes, you know, it sometimes plays a subconscious role in your life. You know, even when you may not be so aware of what your name may sort of represent. So yeah. Moving into your musical career, one of your recent projects was a track called Take Control that you worked on with your 10-year-old son Milo over lockdown. And talking about family earlier, so how did it feel to kind of have your son working with you in this kind of environment? And do you think more and more kids are becoming more drawn to electronic music, even, you know, at that age?
Yeah, I mean, it was quite an exciting project to get to do that with him. I mean, he's obviously from since birth, I've always had a sort of whether it's a relatively small or large studio set up at home in different places where we've lived. So he's always been around me being in this sort of environment. And I guess from an early age, seeing the flashing lights on equipment and it all looks quite exciting. I guess it's quite spaceshipy for a child. But during that whole lockdown process, it was a lot of time spent in the studio, really not really sure what was happening in the world. And we had an opportunity where his school was closed, and it just felt right to maybe do something that's kind of half educational and interesting and stuff together. And got him in the studio, and he was kind of playing. He had GarageBand on his iPad, and he's making kind of loops and melodies and stuff on that just for fun. And he'd let me hear a few bits, and the actual hook melody of that track he played me, and I was like, right, let's record that in and let's do something. And it was quite exciting, I think, for him to be involved and, you know, be part of making some music with his dad for the first time. But to touch on the other point of your question in terms of the younger generations and kids getting involved in electronic music, I do think that the scope for that is getting younger and younger, based on the fact that you have all these relatively cheap and easily accessible applications to write good quality music on, whether it's on iPads or tablets, or even you can even get really good apps now at the most basic level to write music on your phone. So it's a great way of introducing people into kind of electronic music or just music making in general. It doesn't necessarily have to be electronic, but it's just interesting for kids to get to play with that sort of stuff. I mean, if I had that when I was 10 years old, I mean, you'd be a bit mind blown. But now we take it for granted. There's so many apps for everything, but it's quite exciting that kids can do that now.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, not sure if you know, but music in the music GCSE now, DJing and music production is a thing like 40% of the syllabus, which is like amazing considering obviously what kind of sounds what used to be music GCSE. And talking about, you know, the fact that you were sneaking into clubs at a young age, and I was kind of the same actually. I think my first club age 15 was Fabric, which was not the worst place in the world to discover music. And it was that lightning bolt moment when, you know, you hear all those things at home, but then you hear it on the sound system, and it just the sound of a kick drum, and it changes your mind, you know, on so many things. So with that kind of generation, younger generation coming in, do you think that there should be more accessible electronic events for people under the age of 18? They don't have to sneak into clubs necessarily to hear these kinds of things on sound systems.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be a great thing to enable you know, younger people to be able to experience that sort of stuff earlier on in life, definitely. I mean, I think there's a few opportunities now for there's a company called Ravertots, which is kind of specifically aimed at kind of children and under a certain age group to be in that kind of environment, and I guess kind of play around with glow sticks and see the lasers and run around through the smoke machine and kind of listening to music, which is kind of quite a cool concept. But I think that, I guess that sort of stuff's more aimed at quite young kids. I do think there's quite a void for teenagers, as it were, like I guess between kind of 14 to 18. There's definitely a gap there for them to sort of experience that kind of thing, I think. Mm. I mean, in one way, it would be good to have more stuff available for kids that age. But I also think it's quite an exciting age to have to almost wait for your first opportunity to be able to go into a nightclub. Mm. And maybe sometimes if we bring that up experience forward too much, it takes away from that kind of, when you first enter a club legally, you know?
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it could be also the flip side though, that like maybe, experiencing that atmosphere, but without all the, you know, the vices, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that would be quite, that's enough. I guess it's a bit more of a safer environment to do that. I mean, maybe there's an opportunity. Maybe some clubs should pilot some events where they're doing stuff for an under 18s kind of event, you know. I mean, they do happen sometimes. I remember being a kid and going to a nightclub, like I guess it was locally in Southampton. It was like a foam party or something, one of these kind of gimmicky things, but that was aimed at under 18s, and I remember that being pretty cool. But you know, the music was a bit more kind of, I guess, just like pop music, you know, nothing specialist. It wasn't like an under 18 going to Fabric to hear kind of Ricardo Villalobos or something like that. You know, it's kind of, that's a crazy thought, but you know, I guess it would be quite cool if kids could go and see DJs at a younger age. I guess festivals is the only opportunity, really.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think it could be quite cool because also you could learn how to enjoy that music and without anything. And then, you know, later on when you go down that path and you go on their clubbing journey, you know, don't always have to get completely, you know, smashed, as it were, to really enjoy it. How do you feel about that? Do you feel like people need things to enjoy music, or you know, are you an advocate for sort of a cleaner dance floor?
Not really. I mean, ultimately, I think not necessarily a cleaner dance floor, just for me a safer environment, really. You know, if you're going to go and take anything to enhance your musical experience in a club, then make sure you're doing it correctly, safely, with the right amount of advice, and don't be doing it under pressure and that kind of thing, really. But I do think that our industry and certainly electronic music has been kind of is where it is today because of kind of certain aspects of drug culture, acid house and ecstasy and all these kind of things were a big part of the heritage of music. That's not to say that anyone getting into the scene needs to experience that side of it, but ultimately it's very hard to picture nightclubbing without knowing that sort of history that it has with it, you know.
Yeah, no, definitely. And with the kind of recent times we find ourselves in, and obviously, you know, being a incredibly busy touring DJ in the past, how has this kind of time changed perhaps like how your time has been balanced between life as a DJ and a producer and then as a family man as well?
In terms of with the pandemic or just in general?
Yeah, I mean, maybe you could tell us how was it before, you know, and then how has it changed during this time?
I think with the pandemic is just a perfect opportunity was for me to kind of realize how hard I was probably working before, how much I was almost on a bit of a fight or flight. You're touring a lot, you're not sleeping a great deal due to flights in and out, or grabbing sleep when you can when you're extremely busy on tour, how much I wasn't in the studio as much as I kind of wanted to be because I was touring. And when I got home, it was a case of not wanting to really listen to music and more spend time with the family and stuff. All of that stuff was really kind of highlighted when we were forced to stop doing everything that we were doing due to the pandemic, when everything closed down, we were all locked in our homes, there was no clubs, there was no anything, you know, you barely go outside for exercise, you know, you couldn't really do much at all. And I think when I settled into that, I kind of realized how much I valued being with the kids and being able to go and spend time in the kitchen cooking food or going out running or doing sport and being a family man. And it's definitely something I've taken into consideration going back on the road, that I know that stuff is equally as important as touring. So my work-life balance is a lot better now, or at least it will be going forward. The tail end of this year is quite difficult because since we opened in July, we've obviously had so many shows that have been rescheduled from ones that didn't happen over the last 18 months. And it's actually funnel-headed quite a lot of shows. There's quite a lot of things going on. So next year, going into next year, I'm going to hopefully have my diary planned out a lot more efficiently, that it gives me enough time to be at home and as well as touring. Maybe I'll have a weekend off a month or something like this to structure my schedule a bit more to allow for the kind of time that I've been enjoying at home for the last sort of 18 months.
Would you ever see yourself, if a promoter said, you know, would you be up for doing like a hologram sort of gig where, you know, you wouldn't have to leave your place and they come in and do all the setup? Would that world interest you to kind of free up the schedule a little bit?
I think I would be interested in doing that sort of stuff just because, well, from the point of view of that, I would find it interesting on how it would all work, and the sort of inner sci-fi geek of me that I would like to see how that kind of operates. But ultimately, I would, like live streams and stuff like that, I think ultimately I'd struggle because I feed off the crowd a lot when I'm playing. I prefer it to be a live experience where I can see people's reactions firsthand. So, I mean, I think that hologram type approach would only really work for me if there was a way that you could still feel connected to your audience.
No, absolutely agree. So you've released many tracks across many labels over the years, and notably, you know, you're very well known for your affiliation with Drum Code, and you've had a close relationship with Adam Bayer over the last decade, collaborating on many events and many tracks. So what has been the sort of origins of that partnership, and how has it sort of influenced your performances and your creative processes?
Yeah, so I have been a artist on Drum Code for as long as I can remember, really. I mean, I sent Adam some demos back in, I guess, 2007, 2008, somewhere around there. And we've been close friends and label kind of partners, artist partners ever since. We've done lots of music together, as you say. But I think Drum Code was very much a pivotal part of my career, really. When I signed to Drum Code in around 2007, 2008, that was when my career really sort of took a shift, and I really felt part of a sort of a label collective. I mean, back then when I was signed to Drum Code, it was obviously it's always been a huge label, but it was just a record label, kind of huge events and festival stages and stuff everywhere. So it's been great to see that grow and be part of that kind of process. But I would, yeah, me and Adam go way back, and I've got a lot to thank that label for really kind of putting my music on the map, really.
Definitely. And so now, as a producer, do you kind of prefer working solo, or do you still really like the kind of collaborative approach?
I get a buzz doing both, really. I think it's always fun to bounce ideas off of other people and work with other artists. So I do a lot of collaborations. But yeah, there's nothing quite like being able to just sort of do your own thing in your studio on your own and be able to lay down those ideas without any other sort of outside influence, really. So they go hand in hand. I think sometimes I go through periods where I don't want to be collaborating with anyone and just solely sort of focus on my vision. And then in other times I might go back to an idea or a track that I've done and struggle to kind of see where I want to take it. And then it might need me to send it over to someone and say, like, do you want to maybe work on this one together? I'm a bit stuck for where I want to take it. Maybe you've got some ideas. And sometimes that's how, you know, some of the collaborations I've done have been born, just out of sharing ideas with sort of my producer friends. You know, lucky in my kind of role, I've got a lot of producers that are friends, so we bounce ideas off of each other quite a lot, and sometimes collaborations just come out of that.
Definitely, yeah. No, it's really nice sometimes to have that additional pair of ears in the studio, and just to kind of get open up the door to a way that maybe, you know, you just can't in that moment for whatever reason. Or just kind of come in with some fresh ideas. And so talking about kind of doing your own thing, your label, We Are The Brave, has been doing extremely well, unsurprisingly. And the motto is, we do what we want. So does that kind of relate to producing and releasing whatever you really want to do?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the we do what we want phrase is a kind of a way of us thinking that we can kind of approach music in a format where we aren't restricted on boundaries of what style we want to release, when we want to release it, who we want to sign, how we want to promote it. We kind of just ultimately don't have any rule book. So we want to go against the grain sometimes, do things a little bit differently. And ultimately that sort of punk ethos of like, if you're all doing this, then we're going to go do this sort of thing. So that culture we try and instill in the artists that we sign, as well as have that kind of view when we're listening to demos, that ultimately we will approach this in the way that we want to approach it, and we won't be like conforming to any other normal methods, really.
And so this is a very extreme, very exciting time for you and indeed your fans, because by the time this interview is aired, you would have just released your brand new album, Machine Therapy, in November. So this is the first studio album you've released in over a decade. So we're obviously really excited to hear, what's it going to sound like. So tell us a little bit more about the album and kind of what inspired you to write it, and what that journey's been like writing Machine Therapy.
Yeah, I mean, most of the album was actually put together during the whole pandemic lockdown process. And I think it was a good opportunity for me to be able to explore all my different creative kind of paths that I sometimes want to go down. I mean, the beauty of that album, I'll tell you a bit about the title. The reason it's called Machine Therapy is 90% of that album is written with hardware equipment, because over the years, or at least since my last album, I've been collecting and buying new synths and old synths and building my studio up. So a lot of that music has been quite hardware based. And the therapy approach is that sitting in the studio and writing music during that kind of strange time in everyone's lives was quite a therapeutic thing for me. So Machine Therapy is based around that sort of theory. But it's just exciting to be able to get back in the studio and work on a project that was on that scale. I mean, obviously it's been 10 years since the last album, but I've been very prolific in music, so I haven't really gone anywhere. I've ultimately been spending a lot of time on singles and remixes and collaborations. So during that whole period of 10 years from the last one to now, there's still been releases from me probably almost monthly. So it was nice to be able to sit and do something on a larger scale, really. And I just think with the pandemic, it allowed me to work with some artists that I'd never normally get to work with, because our kind of touring schedules or our production schedules weren't in sync. But where everyone was kind of stuck on hold, we effectively got a few things over the line, which were quite exciting. And the album, it's not a club album, it's a much more of a kind of musical experience throughout my kind of creative processes, and more of a kind of, I guess, a Spotify kind of stream listening album with a few club bits in there. It's certainly an album that I'd appreciate that people have a start to finish approach in listening to it, really, because it does for me present itself best if you give it that time, as opposed to kind of jumping in and listening to tracks here and there. It is definitely much more of a sort of processing album of sitting and listening through, and that's sort of the way I intended it to be made, really. Very exciting to be able to have it finally come out. It's been a long time in the making, and I don't know when I'll do another one, because they obviously, well, this one took 10 years. Maybe it'll be another 10 years, who knows. But I'm excited and interested to see what people think.
Definitely. And the machines will look very different in 10 years' time.
Hey, you. We hope you're enjoying today's episode.
We're on a serious mission here to create one of the world's best podcast series, and we'd be so grateful if you could support us in any way by becoming a patron of the show. There's a tier to suit every level, from early bird tiers where you get downloads to all my music with some super cool ninja stickers, to our VIP Mission Maker tiers where you get epic rewards like exclusive footage that never gets aired, the chance to submit questions to our guests with signed copies of books from them, DJ lessons, one-to-one coaching, and a whole load of super cool Ninja and Mission Maker merchandise. You can start supporting us for less than what it costs you to fill up your car for a month by simply heading over to www.patreon.com/missionmakers. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
When you write music, do you have an idea of the song name or the EP's name before you write, or does that kind of come to you sort of after, when you've painted the creative canvas?
A lot of the names of tracks generally come either during or after the process, really. Sometimes it might come quicker if I'm playing with a vocal sample, or if I'm playing with something that immediately triggers a title. But ultimately, a lot of the things like names and kind of themes of tracks generally develop during the same creative process as the music.
Mm. What's the shortest time it took you to produce a track on that album, and what's the longest time?
The longest and the shortest?
Yeah.
I think the longest, probably Warning Signs with Lawrence Hart. My favourite track on the album, it's my Goosebump track. I think it's one of the best tracks I've ever been a part of writing, and that took a long time because we were really kind of precise in terms of adding and taking away bits and bobs, changing vocal aspects to the track and adding in layers. It took a while, but it now sounds great. And we actually got that track mastered at Abbey Road, obviously famous for the Beatles and many other huge bands, but wanted to get that one right. So that one was one of the tracks that took a long time. Quickest track on the album is probably the end track called Unite. Got a large sample in there from a Charlie Chaplin sample from the Great Dictator movie. I think it's from the 20s. But I'd originally had this kind of orchestral chord sequence written for a little while, which didn't take too long to do. And I was struggling with what I wanted to put on the track, and I ended up coming across that sample and using it, and it seemed to fit perfectly. But that one came about much quicker than some of the other more intricate tracks on the album. But yeah, I think Warning Signs was definitely the longest, and I think Unite was probably the shortest.
Would you be able to quantify it?
Probably not.
Okay, fair.
In terms of those two tracks?
Yeah, in terms of those two tracks. We don't have to include like the whole mastering process and everything, but just the creative aspect of, like, you know, writing the concept, the most of the arrangement, being kind of just, yeah, happy with it.
Oh yeah, I mean, in terms of those two tracks, yeah, I mean, me and myself and Lawrence were kind of back and forth quite a lot in terms of the arrangement on that track. We were like, he has vocaled the entire track, so we were kind of playing with multiple chord sequences and with the Moog and arpeggiators and trying to make it sound kind of coherent. And for me, that track really feels like a piece of music as opposed to a kind of track that you go and play on a DJ set. Although people will do that, for me, it's like one of those tracks that really, it's like my Radiohead moment. I think it's one of those tracks that I really feel is a piece of music as opposed to just a club track.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so for this album, you've teamed up with Anjuna Deep. So talk to me about that relationship and why Anjuna Deep for this album.
So I think they've got a great history in terms of kind of more deep melodic and kind of ambient type music, really. I think they've got a huge, huge following with that kind of melodic sound. And you know, originally when I started the album process, I was pretty dead set on doing it on my own label, Brave, but down the process of making the album and the kind of twists and turns that it took musically, it just didn't feel like a We Are the Brave record. It was a lot more, I guess, hard to sum up, probably a lot more musical in terms of what sort of stuff we would normally put out. You know, it's less techno on there and a lot more kind of emotive sounding music. So I needed a new home, really. It needed to go to a fan base that were going to be receptive to that pretty early on. And I'd sent some demos of the album over to Anjuna and to just gauge what they thought about it. And they loved it, and they kind of grabbed it with two hands and we went for it. And I do think that looking back now, looking at where I was looking at positioning the album, I think the it's gone to the best choice, really.
Absolutely. So what would you like to see kind of reset for our industry from this time that we found ourselves in?
Just that people appreciate it more, I think, and then look after each other and kind of from I can only really speak from my own experience, but from my own experience, it's just taught me to kind of life comes first, really, you know. Just don't be rushing into everything and kind of allow space to kind of enjoy things that you enjoy, but also to live kind of in the moment and experience life before work, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. In a previous interview with DJ Mag, you talked about your vision for the future and your desire to branch out further than just the electronic realm, such as clothing and film and TV scoring. So if you could film score one movie, what would it be?
Oh, it would probably be something obvious like Blade Runner, because they're the sort of movies that I get inspiration from in terms of kind of electronic soundscaping and sound design and stuff like that. You know, I'm a big fan of Vangelis's score on that movie, and that would be if I had the opportunity to rescore, it would be a film like Blade Runner, I think, which lends itself to synthesis and electronic music.
Nice. And so with your kind of involvement into releasing this, the more ambient and more sort of harmonic sounds, like, do you see yourself maybe one day like doing that and going into that world of film scoring and stuff?
Yeah, certainly I'd like the opportunity to be able to move into doing that sort of stuff. I have had a conversation in recent times with my publishers about maybe going down that route and doing whether it be sound design for computer games and music for TV and film and stuff. So it's certainly something I'm interested in doing. Again, even at my kind of profile level, another one of those almost closed markets for trying to get into that sort of scene and do that sort of stuff. But I'm in touch with a few people. I know a few directors and stuff that have expressed potential interest, so you never know. I mean, the difficulty at the moment is I'm still very much busy touring and writing music on what I'm already doing, that it would now probably not be the right time to go into that, just based on the fact that I wouldn't be able to give it 110%. But certainly as I get older and as I get more time to do certain things, I'm 100% certain that I will get the opportunity to, at least at an amateur level, do something, and then we'll see where it goes, you know. Maybe I'll approach, do something with my local university, Southampton University, and see if I can help some of the kind of students there score stuff for their own amateur projects and get involved that way. So that'd be quite a cool way of giving something back, I think. Maybe I'll let them use my studio or something.
That sounds pretty cool. Do you collaborate with the university already?
Only in terms of doing some guest lecturing and stuff like that there, really. I've been in there a few times and given some talks about kind of label management and touring and setting up as a sort of DJ and things like that, really. But it's more of an opportunity at that stage for students to ask me questions, because I'm in a role that they may be aspiring to go into. So I'm more there as a kind of to be fired at, questions fired at, really. And hopefully that gives them some insight into what it is that is involved in being a professional artist.
Fascinating. And in that same interview with DJ Mag, it was 2016, and you stated, "I don't want to be DJing when I'm 50 and everyone in the club is 18. Do you still maintain that statement? And do you think maybe age can kind of stunt growth in this kind of industry?
I think when I was quoted saying that, I was probably touring heavily and getting tired. But I think now I've had the reset of so much time outside of clubs with the kind of pandemic stuff. I do think that without putting an age on it, as long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing, I'm still getting the same satisfaction of performing and making music. I don't know if there'd ever be a time when I'd stop. I'd certainly slow down at a certain point, you know, when you're there must come a time when your body's tired of getting up at 2 a.m. and kind of, you know, being subjected to sort of low sleep and bad diet if you're on tour and grabbing food when you can, and a lot of that stuff. There will come a time when that is not as fun as it maybe is now when you're in your 30s. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, if I'm enjoying it, I'm still getting the same kick out of it that I do now, I guess I'll do it forever, you know.
Rave to the grave, as they say.
Rave to the grave, yeah.
How was this kind of summer for you, like with everything changing? Were you able to kind of tour quite nicely? What was the whole vibe like?
Yeah, summer's been great. I mean, as I say, we opened in 23rd, 24th weekend in July. So it's been pretty flat out all of the summer. Getting in all the shows that we missed out on, the big festivals and stuff. Obviously, a few didn't happen, like Glastonbury and stuff like that. But Park Life, Creamfields, and some of these other big festivals I was doing, getting over to Amsterdam for ADE and playing Warehouse Project Manchester, and all of the shows so far have been amazing. The crowd have been great because everybody's been excited to get back out, and you know, I've been enjoying performing and playing music again, and basically getting back to what we were doing, you know, before. So it's been exciting, it's been great, and now I'm looking forward to the next stage, which is kind of darker evenings and back into sort of nightclubs and stuff. Because one thing I will say is I haven't done a great deal of, I've done a few obviously, but I haven't done a great deal of nightclub stuff extensively since we've been back, because it's all really been festivals, day events, and kind of, you know, summery things. So approaching now, coming into sort of November, December time, we'll certainly see DJs getting back into the low ceiling, sweaty clubs and stuff, you know.
Absolutely. It's like nothing's changed, but everything's changed. I went to a club for the first time recently, and yeah, it was definitely an experience. So one thing I want to ask you is, you know, with only 2% of females being music producers, what are your personal thoughts on empowering more women into this scene?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's certainly something we should be focusing on. I think equality on lineups and stuff is a big thing as well, and making sure that kind of, you know, everyone with talent should be getting a look in. You know, everyone that's got ability and kind of that should be on lineups should be on lineups, whether it doesn't matter what kind of gender, race or sexuality you are. You know, you should be on there. We have definitely been through a period where the industry has been quite male dominant, and I think we're now starting to see a shift and the right movement where people are kind of being represented a bit more, and you know, lineups are starting to look a bit more diverse and stuff, and I think we just need to keep on pushing that. My only thing on that is just to make sure that we're all doing it all for the right reasons, and making sure we're pushing the right, you know, not just for the sake of it. I believe that people should be in a position if they are good enough to do that sort of role, you know. And I think there's so many great female artists that should be on lineups that sometimes don't necessarily get a look in. I think that with promoters, I think, have been guilty in times of just sticking with, you know, almost repetition and what works. There's quite a lot of lineups that you can sometimes look at and be like, yes, the same people every year, like, let's mix it up a bit. But I mean, I think again, not to keep referencing the pandemic, but I think it's been another blessing in a way that we've now allowed an extra couple of years of like new up and coming talent to be able to kind of hone their craft through that time and be able to kind of really start pushing some boundaries and breaking through into the scene. So coming out of it, we've now got like lots of fresh new artists that we should be getting excited about.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely couldn't agree more. And as the label owner, are you kind of excited about the world of NFTs?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, we haven't really delved into that yet. I mean, I've got I'd like to start doing some stuff with the guys that I've worked with on my album, some of the design guys that have done the artwork and stuff on that. We've discussed about maybe looking at doing some NFT stuff. But I think that whole thing's in its infancy at the moment. So going forward, and just what I want to make sure with stuff like that is that if we're going to go down that route and do a few NFTs and kind of embrace this new technology, that it needs to be accessible for all fans, really. I mean, there's still a lot of people that have no clue about crypto and no real clue what NFTs even are. So I think we need a bit to educate people a bit more on what that's all about, because what I don't want to do is alienate certain aspects of our fan base by doing stuff that maybe isn't accessible to them. So I think it's something we'll definitely explore. We definitely won't be the last horse to the race. We'll definitely be checking out that technology and keeping a close eye on it, really.
Definitely. And so what's the kind of management style at your label? Like, what's the kind of day in the life for you as a sort of label owner? How many people kind of work with you to kind of bring this vision alive?
So we've now reduced, we've got quite a small team, really. I mean, I've got my label manager and PA, Robin. She is the kind of main life and soul of We Are The Brave, really. I couldn't do it without her, really. She is the day-to-day, I guess, runner of everything in terms of the logistics and the admin side of the label, whether it be looking at the mastering tracks, the deadlines for when releases are coming out, preparing the artwork, along with another guy we've got working with us, Chris. He is our social media and kind of artwork design guy. So yeah, they are pretty much flat out, and I am just the king of delegation, I guess, in that sense, where I'm more the music side. So I will be on a regular basis listening to the demos that we get sent in, planning kind of where we're going to be next, doing We Are The Brave events, looking at new artists to sign, going through the kind of release schedule with Robin and planning out where we're going to be putting releases out. And we're actually in quite an exciting period at the moment, because we're going through or we're just in the early stages of going through a kind of redesign for 2022. So we want to approach next year with a bit of a refreshment on the artwork, new kind of look for our events, and our kind of figurehead, lion head logo is getting a makeover, as it were. Still be the same kind of looking thing, but we're just kind of freshening everything up and going into 2022 with a new kind of I guess a new vision, a new plan, and a new approach to just bringing on new music and new artists and pushing the label bigger than it is now, really. I guess just growing the brand. We're in a nice position where we're doing large scale events, and we've got such a lot of music to come and loads of fresh artists. So now feels like the right time to basically give the whole brand a bit of a facelift and push it into the next century, really. But yeah, we're only a fairly small team. We obviously have a promotional team that we use, and there's myself, there's Robin, there's Chris, and you know, we've got a lot of good loyal friends that come to our events and help out with backstage and the kind of hospitality side of things. So yeah, it's an exciting, fresh, young and vibrant team, really.
Definitely. We're excited to see where the vision evolves in 2022. On the website, the label states that you dare to be different and rip up the rule book. So how do you kind of like to push the boundaries of this scene and also encourage like others to kind of do similar?
I think mainly we're just trying to let that vision sort of talk through the music. I mean, I try and with the whole name of the label, We Are the Brave, we just try and make sure that we are sticking to our, I guess, ethos of releasing brave records and music that is pushing boundaries and is not playing safe or formulaic or copying kind of what's currently popular, and just trying to stay in our own lane in a way and do stuff that that excites us. I mean, I sign a lot of music that people always get confused when they're sending demos. A lot of people send you a demo and it's sounds like you're the last few releases that you've just released, you know, because in their head, that's the sound of the label and that's their way of getting on the label. But for me, what excites me is listening to tracks that make me go like, whoa, like this is mad. And it's something different that I haven't heard before. Or they're the ones that kind of stop you in your tracks and get you excited. Mm. So yeah, that whole ethos of like ripping up the rule book is just trying to get people to know that we like to do things a little bit differently, really.
Definitely. Life is boring to not do things differently. What do you think your team would say about you as a leader? What would they say Alan is like as a boss?
I think I'm probably pretty easygoing. I'm probably one of the easiest bosses you'd get, I would say. I mean, I don't micromanage. I just let people do their thing, and they know what we've got to do. They know what we kind of have as a sort of team goal, and we're regular in meetings and regular in terms of like knowing how we want to present stuff. And you know, it's a pretty well oiled ship. It runs pretty well. I don't feel like they would say I was anything other than supportive and driven, really. So, well, fingers crossed, you know, we'll see. Maybe they'll say something different once they hear this podcast, who knows.
It's no secret that, you know, the dance music industry is highly political, and obviously the life of a DJ is pretty not like the other, not like many other career paths. So when the kind of going gets tough, or just like generally, like how do you like to kind of take care of your mental health?
I have a couple of different pastimes that are, I guess, the opposite to a hectic touring and in loud music spaces type life. I mean, I go carp fishing a lot. So I'm, you know, if I'm not in a nightclub playing 138 BPM techno with a strobe light in your face and stuff like that, I am sat on a lake with surrounded by nature, wildlife, and no sound at all other than maybe the brushing of trees, and sat fishing with either on my own or with friends, and just completely chilling out in nature. One day I'd like to own a fishery and kind of, and maybe have a glamping pods and have some sort of, I guess, farmland and fishery where I could grow that as a sort of luxury campsite type thing where people can come and spend a weekend fishing at your lake and maybe, you know, staying on the facilities and that sort of stuff, which is obviously worlds away from DJs and touring and music. So sitting by a lake and picturesque kind of fishing and stuff. So that's one way. And the other way is I do try to be good at golf. I'm not, but I do try. I play socially with friends and try and get away that way. But one of my other pastimes is boxing. I box a couple of times a week, and I quite like to get rid of energy by hitting the bags and stuff and getting a sweat on that way, really. So those three things are the best way for me to sort of keep my head clear, I think. I do bits of meditation and stuff like that, really. But ultimately, I think for me, keeping my mental health in check works by having the yin and yang of a hectic touring schedule and a hectic lifestyle in terms of music, and then that tranquil side of chill.
Do you have a relationship with music and driving, if you drive?
I never listen to dance music when I'm driving. I never listen to dance music, oddly, outside of kind of getting ready for gigs and stuff. I generally, when I say dance music, that's a bit vague. I should say I don't listen to kind of the music that I DJ when I'm not working. I generally am listening to stuff that's kind of a bit more chill and I guess, kind of down tempo and something that more suits my frame of mind when I'm not working. But yeah, I mean, I do quite enjoy putting on playlists, and you know, if you're on a long drive and just soaking in music that way, it's another good way of chilling. Yeah, it's quite often not what you'd expect. It might even just be that I'm singing along to kind of old 80s love ballads on smooth radio or whatever, you know. But I mean, I enjoy that, you know. I've got a very large eclectic taste in music from a youngster to now. So like a lot of the time I might be listening to whether it's something from the 60s, 70s, 80s or 90s. I'm not often listening to new stuff, especially dance stuff. But I like people like Radiohead and Ben Howard and the DMAs, and I still listen to kind of old Britpop stuff of Blur and Oasis, and I'm a big fan of Kings of Leon. But mainly one of the main artists I listen to a lot of is Ben Howard. I listen to Ben Howard quite a lot.
Very nice. So we're going to move into our audience Q&A. We've got two questions we've selected from our listeners. And the first one comes from Joachim in Paris, and he asks, what's the weirdest thing that you've seen someone do on the dance floor from behind the decks?
I very recently, which is, I'm going to mention this one because it's a nice one, but very recent, I've seen a lot of weird stuff. Don't forget, I played in Berghain and was a resident there for many years. So I've seen a lot of stuff I won't even say on the on the podcast. But in terms of nice things recently, I've seen, which is also quite weird, but a couple got engaged right in front of me on the dance floor at Docklands Festival in Amsterdam, which I thought was pretty nice. That's a special moment to be able to witness someone being proposed to while your kind of music's being played. That's pretty exciting.
You got me curious about the Berghain stuff though. So the next question we have is from Neve in Ireland, and she asks, as a fellow DJ herself, do you have any rituals for preparing for a gig when you go on stage?
Nowadays, now that I'm so sort of seasoned in playing in that whole environment of going on stage, my process is probably the only one thing that runs from start to finish from when I started to sort of now is I love tequila. So generally I will have two shots of tequila before I start to play. But in terms of like that sort of when you're on stage, I always just find that, like, you know, that just sort of gets me in the mood, really. But in terms of like rituals, in terms of preparing music and stuff like that, I if I'm in my hotel room, I always like to sort of make sure that I've got everything prepared, going through music, making sure my playlists are in order, not stressing too much about stuff. You know, I would like to kind of think that the music should run pretty freely on stage, rather than you kind of already knowing in your head what you're going to play. If I've got a 2-hour set, for example, that might be 35 tracks. My playlist will probably be 100 tracks, and I'll go through and, you know, feel that out while I'm playing, as opposed to being too stringent.
Interesting. And so we're going to move on to our quick fire round. So not more than 60 seconds on each question. The first question is, who has been the biggest inspiration in your life?
Biggest inspiration in my life is probably, to date, been my kids. I think watching them grow into kind of little humans and knowing that that's something that you as a person kind of mold and shape, that's kind of incredible for me. And I think the day I became a father, I get inspired by them daily.
That's awesome. That leads quite nicely onto our second question, which is, do your kids enjoy listening to your music?
They do. Certain tracks, certainly, yeah. Certain tracks they play, and that's kind of cool. They get to kind of watch little YouTube clips of me playing maybe to 25,000 people and at festivals, and that's kind of exciting for them to see, I think. So, yeah, they're always having a little dance to stuff. They know a couple of tracks.
Nice. Number three, what's the best purchase you've ever made?
I guess the best purchase I've ever made would be my Roland 909 drum machine. For me, especially for music wise, it is the techno machine, you know, and going back to the days of the master, Jeff Mills. My drum machine is actually called Jeff, after Jeff Mills. But yeah, that machine was something I'd always dreamt of having as a kid and I never could afford. So having the ability to own one of those now is pretty special. And I'll never, ever get rid of it.
Fantastic. I love it. Number four, who's your favourite DJ to play back-to-back with?
I've played back-to-back with a lot of people, actually, but I think historically my favourite back-to-backs have probably been with Adam Bayer. We've done it a lot and our musical kind of minds work quite similarly, so it flows very naturally. And we always have a lot of fun. We haven't done a back-to-back for a long time now, for a few years, but in terms of historic back-to-backs that I've done, I would say that I've had most enjoyment playing with Adam.
To kind of just break the rules a little bit here with the 60 seconds, I just want to ask real quick, like, how do you prepare for a back-to-back with Adam? Like, do you guys collaborate before, or is it just completely on the night, in the moment of the set?
I mean, every single back-to-back I've ever done in my career, right through from whether it be with all of the artists I've played back-to-back with, whether it's Maceo, Plex, Adam Bayer, Luigi, Madonna, Scream, Eats Everything, all of these people, I've never prepared. We always just feel it out on stage.
Nice. Awesome. I love it. And lastly, Alan, something we love to ask all of our guests as the closing question on this podcast is, what are you most grateful for this month? And I know the month has only just begun, so maybe we can reference it to last month.
Last month, I am most grateful for the United States government granting me my exemption letter, which is going to allow me to go on tour in America. I haven't been to America in over 2 years, and I miss performing for people over there. So I'm actually going to LA and then Austin very soon. And yeah, I'm grateful that they have finally allowed touring artists into the country so that I can fulfill playing to fans over there. Yeah.
What's your favorite state to play in there?
I really enjoy New York. I do like Miami. But to be fair, it's such a vast place to play music in terms of the size of the country and the states that they're all unique, you know, they're all very different. But New York does hold a special place. It's the first state I ever played in when I was touring over the states, the first place that I ever ever performed. So that would be my go-to for nostalgic reasons, I guess.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy how we Brits have not been allowed into the States for almost 2 years, as you say. But yes, hopefully the tide is changing now and it's all systems go stateside. So good luck when you do go out there. Thanks, and all the best. Hope you get to make it. And you, Alan, thank you so much for your time and for your insights. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you and hearing more about your journey and, of course, learning more about the album as well, which we're super excited to listen to as well.
No worries. Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
So guys, if you haven't already, go out there and listen to Alan's album, Machine Therapy. It's super interesting to hear how he's fused sci-fi sonics with dystopian samples and taken inspiration from the early days of raving to transport listeners into his therapeutic zone. And if you want to grab a copy of today's show notes, then head over to missionmakers.com/Alan Fitzpatrick, where you'll also find notes from all of our previous episodes. We've got some amazing guests coming on the show this season, so be sure to share the show with your friends and subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and wherever else you listen to your podcasts. You can reach out to me on Mission Makers or at dj.n1nja on Instagram. And if you're interested in supporting the show and getting some really cool rewards like DJ lessons and exclusive merchandise, then don't forget to visit www.patreon.com/missionmakers. Thank you for listening, and until next time, keep it laser focused. Thank you.